Mungo St. John had not stopped smiling. But now he held out his right hand, without once taking his eyes off the Portuguese's face. Out of the ranks of the watchers emerged a large toad-like figure with a head as round and as bald as a cannonball. Tipu moved with reptilian speed to Mungo St. John's right side. He placed a knife in the outstretched hand, and then unknotted the embroidered sash from his waist and handed that to his captain. Mungo wrapped the sash around his left forearm, still smiling softly to himself. He had not once looked up at Robin, though she had not been able to tear her own eyes from his face. He seemed godlike to her at that moment. Everything about him, the darkly classical features, the wide shoulders under the white cloth of his shirt, the narrow waist clinched with a broad belt of polished leather, the strong straight legs in tightly fitted breeches and soft leather boots, seemed to have come down directly from Olympus. She would have gladly thrown herself at his feet and worshipped him. Just below Robin, Camacho was stripping off his own jacket and wrapping his guard arm with it. Then, with the long knife in his right hand, he made a low, swift cut, forehand and then backhand, so the steel whispered as it dissolved into a silver blur like the wing of a dragonfly in flight. At each stroke he ducked his head slightly and flexed his knees, loosening and warming his muscles like an athlete before the contest. Then he moved forward, stepping lightly in the treacherous mud and weaving the point of the knife to distract and intimidate his adversary. The smile went from Mungo St. John's lips, to be replaced by a grave and attentive expression, like a mathematician considering a complex problem. He kept his own knife low, advancing his wrapped forearm and balancing easily, stood his full height and turned gently to face the Portuguese as he circled. It reminded Robin of the night she had watched him on the dance floor at Admiralty House, so tall and graceful, so balanced and controlled in each movement. Now, at last, the watchers were silent, straining eagerly for the first glimpse of blood. But when Camacho charged, they roared the way the crowd roars when the bull first bursts into the ring. Mungo St. John barely seemed to move, swaying his body at the hips, so the knife slid past him, and then he was facing Camacho again. Twice more the Portuguese attacked, and both times Mungo St. John moved effortlessly aside, but each time he gave a little ground, until he was backed up to the first rank of watchers, then began to fall back to give the American room to fight. But Camacho saw his opportunity, as Mungo was crowded like a prize fighter against the ropes, and he swung back to attack. At the same moment, almost as though it had been rehearsed, a booted foot shot out from the crowd. Nobody was sure whose foot it was, for the throng was closely packed and the light uncertain. But the kick to the back of Mungo St. John's heel almost brought him down sprawling in the mud. He lunged to catch his balance, but before he could do so, Camacho hit him with the long, bright blade. Robin screamed, and Mungo St. John spun away from the sting of the steel, with scarlet spreading wetly down his shirt front like rich burgundy wine, spilled on a damask tablecloth, and his own knife flicked out of his hand and was lost in the red mud. The crowd bellowed, and Camacho swarmed in eagerly, following the wounded man the way a good dog hunts a pheasant with a broken wing. Mungo was forced to give him ground, falling back, clutching the wound, dodging and weaving, catching a forehand slash on his wrapped guard arm so the embroidered cloth split almost to the flesh beneath it. Skillfully, Camacho herded him towards the auction block. And when Mungo felt the poles catch in the small of his back, he froze for a moment as he realized that he was trapped. Camacho drove in at him, going for the belly, his lips drawn back, baring his perfect white teeth. Mungo St. John caught the knife on his guard and then snatched a grip on the wrist with his right hand. The two men stood chest to chest, their arms entwined like vines on a trellis, swaying slightly as they strained together, and the effort brought a fresh flood of bright blood from Mungo's wound. But slowly he forced Camacho's knife hand upwards, bending it at the elbow, until the point was no longer aimed at Mungo's belly, but at the night sky above them. Mungo shifted his feet, gathering himself, and then his face darkened, his jaw clenched, and his breath sobbed with effort. Slowly, Camacho's wrist gave to the pressure, and his eyes widened as the point of his own knife reversed towards him. Now he also was wedged against the side of the auction block and could not break away. And infinitely slowly, but inexorably, the long blade moved towards his own chest. Both men stared down at it, their hands and arms interlocked, pitting their strength to hold each other. But the point touched Camacho's chest. A drop of blood welled up at the tiny prick. On the block beside Robin, Alphonse Pereira drew the pistol from his belt with a furtive movement. But before she could shout a warning, there was a blur of movement, and Tipo, the mate, towered beside him, his own huge, smooth-bore pistol pressed to the side of Alphonse's skull. The little Portuguese rolled his eyes sideways at Tipu, and then hurriedly returned the weapon to his belt, and Robin could watch again with fascinated horror the contest at her feet. Mungo St. John's face was congested with dark blood, every muscle in his shoulders and arms raised in knots under the thin shirt, his whole existence concentrated on the knife, and he slid his left foot back until it was anchored against the auction block, and then, using it as a pivot, hurled all his weight forward onto the knife. The final effort, like the matador going over between the horns for the kill. For a moment longer, Camacho resisted him, and then the blade resumed its forward movement, entering Camacho's chest as slowly as a python swallows a gazelle. Camacho's mouth opened in a cawing burst of despair, and suddenly his fingers opened as all resistance and strength went out of them. His own blade, with Mungo St. John's full weight behind it, shot its length into his chest with such force that the crosspiece of the hilt struck against his ribs with a sharp thump. Mungo St. John released his grip and let him fall face forward into the mud, while he himself caught at the edge of the auction block for support. Only then did he lift his chin to look up at Robin. "Your servant, ma'am," he murmured. And Tipu rushed forward to catch him before he fell. Huron seamen, all of them armed, formed a guard about them, and Tipu led them holding aloft a bullseye lantern, which he shone into the shadows as they hurried down the path. Mungo St. John was on his feet, but supported by Nathaniel, his boatswain, and Robin had bound up the wound roughly with a strip of linen torn from a seaman's shirt, and had used the rest of the shirt to make a sling for Mungo's right arm. Through a grove of mangroves they reached the bank of the creek, on which the barracoons had been built, and in the centre of the stream, her bare masts and yards silhouetted against the starry sky, lay the lovely Clipper. She had lanterns in her rigging, and an alert anchor watch, for at Tipu's first hail, the whaler swung away from her side and was rowed swiftly to the bank where they stood. Mungo climbed the ship's side unaided, but sank down with a grateful sigh onto his bunk in the stern cabin, the bunk that Robin remembered so vividly. She tried to force the memory from her mind and keep her manner brisk and businesslike. "They have taken my medical chest," she said, as she rinsed her hands in the porcelain basin at the head of the bunk. "Tipu," Mungo looked up at his mate, and the bald, scarred head bobbed once, and then Tipu ducked out of the cabin. Mungo and Robin were alone, and she tried to remain remote and professional as she made her first examination of the wound in good lantern light. It was narrow, but very deep. She did not like the angle of the thrust, just below the collarbone, but angled in towards the point of the shoulders. "Can you move your fingers?" she asked. He lifted his hand towards her face and touched her cheek lightly. "Yes," he said, as he stroked her, "very easily." "Don't," she said weakly. "You are sick," he said, "so thin and pale."
"It is nothing. Lower your arm, please."
She was terribly conscious of her matted hair and filthy mud-stained clothing, of the yellow tinges of fever on her skin, and the dark smudges of fatigue and terror under her eyes.
"Fever?" he asked quietly, and she nodded as she went on working on the wound. "Strange," he murmured. "It makes you seem so young, so fragile." He paused. "So lovely."
"I forbid you to talk like that." She felt flustered, uncertain of herself. "I said I would not forget you."
He ignored the instruction. And I did not. If you don't stop, I will leave immediately. When I saw your face tonight in the light of the fires, I could not believe it was you. And at the same time, it was as though all our lives we had a rendezvous to keep here tonight. As though it had been destined from the moment of our births. Please, she whispered. Please stop. That's better. Please is better. Now I will stop. But he watched her face attentively as she worked. In the ship's medical chest, which he kept in the locker below his bunk, Robin found most of what she needed. He neither flinched nor grimaced as she laid the stitches in the wound, but went on watching her. You must rest now, she said as she finished, and he lay back on the bunk. At last he looked tired and drained, and she felt a rush of gratitude, of pity, and of that other emotion which she had believed had so long ago been subdued. You saved me. She dropped her eyes, no longer able to look at him, and busied herself with repacking the ship's chest. I will always be grateful for that, just as I will always hate you for what you are doing here. What am I doing here? He challenged her lightly. Buying slaves, she accused. Buying human lives, just as you bought me on the slaving block. But for a much lower price, he agreed as he closed his eyes. At $20 gold a head, there is not much profit in it, I assure you. She awoke in the small cabin, the same cabin in which she had sailed the length of the Atlantic Ocean, and in the same narrow, uncomfortable bunk. It was like homecoming. And the first thing she saw after her eyes had adjusted to the harsh beam of sunlight through the skylight were the chests of her medical instruments, her remaining medicines, and her few personal possessions. She remembered the unspoken command that Mungo had given to the mate the previous evening. Tipu must have gone back ashore during the night, and she wondered what price he had paid, or what threat he had made to get them back for her. She rose swiftly from her bunk, ashamed of her sloth. Whoever had left the chests had also filled the enamel jug with fresh water. With relief she washed away the mud and filth and combed the tangles of her hair before finding worn but clean clothing in her chest. Then she hurried from her cabin down to the master's quarters. If Tipu had been able to find her chests, then he might be able to find and free her people, the Hottentots and porters, who had gone up on the auction block in the firelight. Mungo's bunk was empty. The vest and blood-stained shirt bundled and thrown into a corner of the cabin, and the bedclothes in disarray. She turned swiftly for the deck, and as she came out into the sunlight, she saw that it would be only a temporary respite from the monsoon, for already the thunderclouds were boiling up over the horizon. She looked about her quickly. Huron lay in the centre of a broad estuary, with mangroves on each bank, and the bar and the open sea was not in sight, though the tide was ebbing, rustling down the ship's hull and leaving the mud flats half exposed.